Okay, so today I'm with Will and David, and we're going to talk about how Islamist groups have sort of fared and succeeded or failed during the Arab Spring. So let me start with Will. Let's talk about, how have the Salafis in Egypt, how have they viewed the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power, A, and then B, sort of being ousted out of power. Has this, do they view it as, is it sort of a positive, or is it a negative, or is it, my sense is that they're sort of thumbing their noses and saying, told you so, this is what happens when, we told you this would happen if you came to power.
I'm gonna go with the safe mixed bag option. And so for some of the Salafis, they have been very unhappy with the Brotherhood's fall to power. And these are the smaller Salafi parties that align themselves with the Brotherhood. The large Salafi party, the Nur party, which is the second largest Islamist party in Egypt behind the Brotherhood, they have been competing with the Brotherhood from the beginning. And so the Brotherhood's fall is to their advantage, and in some ways they help to engineer that fall. So I think they've been fairly happy with the outcome. It's being debated right now whether they stand to pick up any of the Brotherhood's, votes that would go to the Brotherhood in the upcoming elections. But certainly having the Brotherhood disgraced makes them somewhat more appealing, and they've proven themselves to be more capable political players in the Brotherhood. I mean, the Nur Party saw itself, I think, primarily as the pure alternative to the Brotherhood, and they, they're playing to the extreme far right religious folks in Egypt. And as such, they don't really have pretensions to be a mass party like the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood, at least in its political program before it came to power, was a big tent Islamist party. There's liberal Islamists in there's very conservative Islamists in the Brotherhood, including some Salafis. The Nur Party positioned itself to appeal to the ultra-conservative in Egypt. And so they never were really chained by a desire to please everybody. And in some ways, this makes them a more flexible actor. As I said, the smaller parties are the ones that are really hurting. Many of them align themselves against the Nur Party and with the Brotherhood because they were hoping to benefit from the Brotherhood's largesse. And obviously, it hasn't worked out for them, and that's why you see groups like the Gamaan, its political party, Construction and Development, making noises or hinting at engaging in violent action in reprisal to what the military did.
How would you describe the newer party's political platform? I mean, is this, I mean, it seems like, from a layman's perspective that they would be anti-democratic, and yet they sort of have embraced, not necessarily democratic institutions, but sort of democratic politics and sort of, aligning themselves with different parties in order to sort of come to power. I mean, describe, walk us through sort of the newer party's political platform and sort of.
Yeah, I think you have to distinguish between two things. There's sort of the broad notion of a liberal democracy, which Nur may bite off on parts of it, but the parts that have to do with individual rights, human rights, those sorts of things, they are not going to be helpful. They are going to be happy to see free speech repressed. They're going to be happy to see women's rights and minority rights repressed. So in those ways, they're bad Democrats. But on procedural issues, they can be quite good precisely because they are a minority party, and because of their extreme views, will never be a majority party. They have to work with other minorities to get things done. And that's why you have seen them reach out to the more secular groups when they felt slighted by the Brotherhood. And so we've seen this in where we have Salafi parties or political blocs in Kuwait and Bahrain. They are more willing to work with folks you might consider to be their natural opponents, say the liberals or the secularists, if it helps them advance their own agenda in parliament. In other words, gives the parliament more powers, so the Salafis can then try and implement their conservative social position. So it's not a straight they're democratic or anti-democratic. It depends on the issue and what they're trying to achieve.
Interesting. So let me switch to David then. What has been the reaction to Morsi's ouster in Tunisia? I mean, is this sort of, you know, regionally and especially in, you know, Tunisia, was this shocking? That was Morsi's ouster by protests and then the military sort of, you know, was this politically shocking? Was this, you know, are people scrambling to sort of change political platforms and to, you know, be more inclusive? What has been the reaction?
People are scrambling for sure. This has had tremendous ripple effects, not just in Tunisia, but throughout the entire region. It's had ripple effects in terms of the foreign policy that countries like Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar are all pursuing. Within Tunisia, you've had a very similar situation to Egypt, with a lot of important differences, but a similar situation in that, quite obviously, those are both countries in which you experienced a change of regime that was forced by protests, and you had an old dictatorship get toppled without the protracted conflict that you had in either Libya or Syria. As a result of not having protracted conflicts in Egypt and Tunisia, you've had relative stability of transition. You haven't had the kind of bloodshed and state retreat that you've seen in Libya and that you are seeing right now in Syria with all the tragic deaths that are being caused there. And also in both countries, you've had Islamist parties get elected controversially. And what I mean by that is not that the election itself was controversial, but the way that they've ruled thereafter has been controversial and justifiably so, particularly in the case of the Brotherhood. Many of the things that Morsi did, for example, the power grab he had back in November, were not consonant with democratic governance. That's not to justify the civil society coup that came later, which I think is probably the best way to describe what happened. So in Tunisia, you have two separate sets of reactions. One is from Tunisia's Islamists, which are represented in the Ennahda party. And they were very, very quick to do two things, one of which was to condemn the coup in Egypt in vociferous terms. The reasons why are obvious. Not only was the Brotherhood government there something of an ally, but there's also obviously a concern that, similarly, they could be ousted from power in a way that they feel would be unfair. There's clearly a concern about that. But the second thing that the Ennahda party has done at the same time, and this goes to Rashid Ghannouchi, who is a top-level intellectual and leader within that organization, they have distinguished their leadership from that of the Brotherhoods. Not vociferously, but rather subtly explaining that they have been much more of a consensus-building party rather than the Brotherhood in Egypt, which they are portraying, again, subtly as being a party that essentially shoved their ideals down other people's throats. Now, the flip side of that is secularists in Tunisia who would disagree with Ennahda's framing. If you look at the Tunisian political scene, it is extremely divided between Islamists and secularists. The debate centers around the role of religion in society. And if you look at some of the secularist views, they believe that they will argue that religion is essentially being shoved down their throats. And there's been some, you can see this in press reporting, there's been some rumbling among secularists on the streets of Tunis and elsewhere about how they wish something like this would happen in Tunisia. This is likely to make political debate within Tunisia more contentious. It's already been quite contentious for some time, but adding this dimension of the Brotherhood being ousted when civil society groups came out to the streets in Egypt, that increases the likelihood of groups in Tunisia seeing contentious protest as perhaps a way to topple Ennahda. One final thing I should note is that the situation of the two militaries are very different. The military is a much weaker institution in Tunisia than it is in Egypt.
So then let's sort of talk about this. And I mean, what has been the military's role in Egypt? I mean, it seems like you couldn't have the coup and the ouster without the military. I mean, even if we, I think there's a larger question here about, whether, do you should there be a respect for civilian rule, you know, and process versus the larger question of, you know, elections and sort of democracy writ large? I mean, you know, what has been the role of the military in sort of defining itself versus these Islamist parties, and the Islamist parties defining themselves against the military in both Egypt and Tunisia?
Well, I think there's no question that the ouster of Morsi would not have happened without the military. I mean, nobody could honestly say otherwise. I used the term before, civil society coup, which is a term that Michael Stevens coined a while back. And I have the author wrong on that. It was Omar Encarnacion who coined that phrase a long time ago. He used that in 2002 to describe the very brief ouster of Hugo Chavez from power. And, you know, it's been applied to a number of other cases, the Philippines in 2001, Ecuador, Thailand, Honduras. But at any rate, what it represents is that it's not just a simple coup. It's not just the military suddenly seizing power, as you saw, for example, in Pakistan, when our friend Pervez Musharraf ended up taking power. Instead, you had civil society align against the government. And so the military, in seizing power, can claim to be acting on the will of the people, which is exactly what has happened in Egypt. That being said, it's still quite clearly a coup. Now, we can get into a debate about, you know, is this okay? But I'll say that, to me, I'm never going to celebrate a military coup. You know, Morsi was governing in a way that was anti-democratic. I think that it's very difficult to deny that. But it's also difficult to say that a coup is a democratic mechanism in and of itself. I think that that being said, the coup has happened. You know, it's something we have to deal with. That the Rubicon has been crossed and we're not going back. And to me, I think the important thing on the U.S.'s part right now is to try to tamp down some of the worst impulses of the military coup, because a lot of things could go wrong. A lot of things could go very wrong. I mean, one thing to worry about is the possible return of the Brotherhood or some factions of the Brotherhood to embracing a strategy of violence, something they had moved away from over the past few decades. Another thing to worry about, Will talked about how various Salafi parties, those competing in the political process, are positioning themselves. There's also those Salafi groups that refuse to participate in the political process because they believe that democracy is something they should not take part in at all. Those who are on the Salafi jihadist side of the spectrum. You also have those on the quietist side of the spectrum, but those aren't really anybody's concern as a security threat. If you look at the arguments that Ayman al-Zawahiri, the emir of al-Qaeda, has made over the past several years about participation in democratic process, parts of those are looking very persuasive right now. And this is something that I think that Salafi jihadist groups believe will very much bolster their narrative about how democracy is a sham. You can't detain power that way, and so you need a different approach. You know, I'm concerned about both of those potentials for violence, and therefore I think that the U.S.'s policies should be focused on tamping down the worst impulses of this military regime, and we're seeing some of the worst impulses coming to the fore over the past few weeks, including their roundup of Brotherhood leaders.
So, I mean, let me ask it this way. I mean, you know, I mean, you're discussing sort of dampening down. I mean, but then what is the sort of the end goal then? I mean, it seems like, you know, what sort of brought the Muslim Brotherhood to power and what sort of the Noor Party uses is a democratic process, you know, elections, and, you know, they came to power. I mean, but, you know, I mean, it seems like the Muslim Brotherhood and even the Noor Party, maybe, you know, they have a good grasp of electioneering and sort of elections, but not necessarily governance. So, I mean, you know, walk us through. I mean, is there a tension for Islamist parties that not only do they have to be able to win elections, but also be able to govern? Because it really seems like
Well, yes. I mean, that's the precise challenge to them for quite some time. The way Islamist groups were seen is that they were desirable to elect. And I mean that a lot of people in the region who voted for them saw them this way, that they were desirable to elect because they, unlike the old regimes, they aren't corrupt. and they are competent groups who are ready to govern. And the Brotherhood's governance in Egypt has entirely disproven that stereotype of Islamist groups. It's shown that they are, in fact, not particularly good, or at least the Brotherhood was not particularly good at governance. And so, if you look at who turned out on the streets, some of the people who turned out to protest were people who, in fact, voted for the Brotherhood, people who aren't Islamists, but thought that at least their competence and their lack of corruption could get Egypt's economy going. That, of course, did not happen.
Right.
Tina, if I could just disagree a bit with David, I don't think it has entirely, the Brotherhood has entirely discredited themselves. And I think this is one of the main problems with the coup, is it did not allow the Brotherhood to fully demonstrate the depth of its incompetence. And I think it can legitimately say to its followers, look, we weren't really given a chance. We got 12 months before the military stepped in. We were embattled on all sides. We had the results of the parliamentary election canceled. The courts were running rampant. We were never given a shot. And I think that's one of the biggest shames of the coup, is that the Brotherhood, the founding organization of the Brotherhood, was not given a full chance to fail. And so it remains a potent opposition ideology.
And to be clear, I don't disagree with that. I was not saying they'd completely discredited themselves, but rather, I mean, to most observers looking at it, it certainly calls the stereotype that they are competent, that they'd be competent at governing into question. But in terms of the perceptual mechanism you're talking about, I fully agree, Will.
I mean, then is there a sort of, I mean, to sort of, you know, I mean, do you think the coup then is beneficial to the Muslim Brotherhood? Then, I mean, it seems like, you know, being ousted from power, they can sort of, you know, recreate a narrative of victimhood, of being, you know, alienated and saying, you know, look what happened. Not only, you know, to build on Will's point, you know, we only had 12 months, and now not only are we being ousted out of power, but now we're being arrested. You know, it's, you know, back to the days of Mubarak and, you know, whomever. I mean, does this sort of, do you think that the Muslim Brotherhood will, you know, sort of begin to build this narrative of victimhood, of, you know, not being given a chance?
I think Will, go ahead and take the first crack at that one.
Okay. Absolutely. I think it let them off the hook. It completely let them off the hook. I mean, as David was saying, they were bumbling and fumbling in their efforts to govern. And I don't think it allowed them to fully fail. And I think it's, you know, the opportunity to rebuild its brand is going to be there for them now because the military short-circuited the process.
So, I mean, let me add then, you know, do you think, David, that Tunisia will, you know, go through a similar process then? I mean, do you think, I mean, you mentioned that the military is weaker in Tunisia. So, you know, is there a chance that we would see something, you know, like a coup in Tunisia?
I don't think so, period, that we'll see a coup. I think that we're much more likely to see the opposition use street protests with the belief that if civil society turns out in a large way, that can discredit and topple the Ennahda party. But I don't think that we'll actually see that manifest itself within a coup in Tunisia along the same model that we've seen within Egypt.
I mean, do you think, you know, it's, I mean, I'm trying to sort of approach an answer or a question involving the military, because it really seems like, you know, if we were to compare Egypt and Tunisia, you know, both of them, they're similar in that, you know, as David has pointed out, they haven't had that serious style, you know, overturning and sort of reset, violent reset of the state. So, I mean, you know, do Islamist parties work within the institutions of the state, or, you know, have they been able to sort of either subvert or change those institutions? Because it seems like, especially in our Egypt example, you know, we keep coming back to the military. And I'll even add the judiciary and sort of the other sort of institutions of the state that the Muslim Brotherhood weren't able to change. So, I mean, walk us through, have they been, able to change the institutions of the state, A, and then B, have they been successful? Has, what has been the response back from those institutions?
Okay, so just to start with, when you're talking about the distinctions between Tunisia and Egypt, I think a good thing to look at is the reason why Tunisia's institutions are different than Egypt's. When Ben Ali came to power, one thing he was concerned about was that a military that was too strong could be used to topple him. And so he very purposefully kept the military from growing to be as powerful an institution as Egypt's military has been. Instead, basically the presidential guard was used as the elite force within Tunisian society, which is something that caused a great deal of resentment upon other aspects of the security services. Now, I think that if you look at tampering with institutions by Islamist parties, that happened to a much greater degree within Egypt than Tunisia. And to point to a few different reasons why I say that, I mentioned before Morsi's power grab, which I think was fairly clearly anti-democratic. Another thing you can look at is the arrest of journalists within Egypt and perceived opponents of the regime. That was another thing that in my view, was anti-democratic, and I think inarguably so. You haven't seen the same extent of things like that occurring within Tunisia. There's one thing that can be pointed to, which is legitimately extremely problematic, which is an opposition politician named Shokri Belaid, who was assassinated. Now, there's some question about who assassinated him. Tunisian government and Ennahda have been pointing to Salafi jihadists as being behind the assassination. Other observers believe instead that a non-governmental group, the League for the Protection of the Revolution, may actually be behind it. And that's a group that is heavily associated with Ennahda. I mean, if that theory is correct, then that also falls into the obviously extremely problematic category. But there are questions about evidence of it, and basically what we have is supposition and people drawing inferences about who's most likely to be behind that assassination. But in terms of the very obvious things that were done in Egypt, you haven't seen the same overt anti-democratic actions coming out of Ennahda at the same scale as you did from the Brotherhood.
Interesting. Well, I mean, do you want to respond to that or?
I think the Brotherhood government in Egypt was faced with a real problem. I mean, its economy is completely in the tank. I think Tunisia is faring much better. He is beset on all sides. The government is beset on all sides by state institutions with an interest in keeping the Brotherhood out of its internal affairs. I mean, Nathan Brown wrote a great article today on the wide state in Egypt, but he goes on to point out that the Morsi's problems are not just with the military, but with a whole host of institutions that are just very hostile to any kind of revolutionary changes. I mean, they always want their own leadership promoted from within, and I don't think the Brotherhood really made any sort of dent in it. And the Brotherhood has a history in Egypt of being brilliant organizers, particularly in getting their own people into the leadership roles in guilds and university boards and so on and so forth. And even they weren't able to make a dent in it. And I think this is a long-term structural problem that the revolution in Egypt is going to face, no matter who comes into power. And as David is saying, I don't think Tunisia has the same sort of problems. It also helps that Ennahda has been more conciliatory towards the non-Islamist parties. And so I don't think they are facing the same kind of alliances against them that the Brotherhood was facing, where you have the National Salvation Front, which is quite secular, teaming up with the ultra-conservative Salafi Party. I mean, Tunisia just doesn't have the same kind of headaches.
Right. And another thing that you don't have in Tunisia is you don't have a major Salafi party that's part of the government to the right of Ennahda. You do have some Salafis that are participating within the political system, but not in the way that the Nur party is. So Will is right that the kind of coalition, including Islamists, against Ennahda is very, is very unlikely. I do see other, opportunities for coalitions against them. And look, the anger in Tunisia is very real. But like that configuration that Will talked about is simply not going to happen in Tunisia.
So then, I mean, for Islamist parties, then, is the challenge for rule, does it come from, to the right of them or to the left? In the sense that, does the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt view the Nur party as more of a challenge and a challenger than, let's say, leftist parties? And the same with Tunisia. Does the challenge come from, their own ideology or from people outside of that ideology? Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I can say for Egypt that certainly Nur was a headache, but it didn't need to be that big of a headache. The Morsi government could have co-opted Nur early on by giving them some choice cabinet appointments, which it did not do. So it made an early enemy that never went away. And Nur has, about a quarter of the seats in parliament, a lot of political clout, and was very savvy about using it. I mean, as David said, you just don't have that kind of parliamentary pressure on the Islamist right in Tunisia. You have a different kind of pressure, which is more of these Hezbollah politics or vigilante politics, street politics among the Salafis. But it's not playing out in parliament in the way it does in Egypt.
Right, I'd agree with that statement, and you add that Rashid Ghannouchi, who I mentioned before, has talked about, Rashid Ghannouchi of Ennahda, has talked about how he prefers a soft line in dealing with the Salafi jihadist group Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia. And let me just quickly say that Tunisia actually has ramped up as opposed to maintained a soft line for a variety of reasons. But at any rate, when he was making this argument some time ago, he analogized Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia to early Ennahda, who were cracked down on by the state. And he said, you don't want to suppress them, marginalize them, and stigmatize them, because if you do, then they'll find themselves, then we'll find them in power in 15 years. Instead, you have to have, you have to create a path for participation on their part. Now, I mention that because I believe that statement to entirely be hyperbole on the part of Ghannouchi. AST is influential beyond its numbers. It's growing, but it's still very much marginal numerically in a way that the Nur party is not. Someone I spoke to in Tunisia, an insider to that movement, analogized the Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia as being like Goths in the U.S., like the goth kids in South Park. Nobody's going to, they're that marginal. They're not something that you're going to see when you're, walking down the street. I went to plenty of places when I was doing field research in Tunisia where I could very visibly see Salafis, but that's because I chose to do so. Had I remained in city centers, I would barely have encountered them in places like Susa or in Tunis. That being said, it's something that's seen as a challenge, particularly a security challenge. But if you look at who Ennahda, I think, would be primarily concerned about, they're concerned, I think, much more about the secular opposition, which poses much more of a direct threat to their political power than they are to Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia, which can create problems on the streets, but isn't going to topple Ennahda from power.
See, now I want to distance myself from David's goth kids remark. I feel like that's going to alienate half of your listenership. So that's all David. I love the goth.
No, we have a lot of nerds, not necessarily goth kids.
To clarify, though, I was not criticizing the goth kids. I was merely saying that there just aren't that many goths, just to be very clear, and so as not to have angry tweets directed by my way by goths.
Oh, it's all right. Let me switch a little to the issue of violence and stability. Particularly, how has Al-Qaeda reacted to the Arab Spring? It really seems like, they would, as a layman, it seems like they would be thumbing their noses at, at the attempts of Morsi to, to be elected at the the whole democratic process. I mean, walk us through, either of you, what has been Al-Qaeda's sort of, not only its political reaction, but is it sort of gearing up to, to recruit and to sort of, to sort of engage in violence?
I think one thing about the current environment is it's a little bit difficult, in my view, to talk about Al-Qaeda to talk about it separately from Salafi jihadism, in part because my view is that Al-Qaeda's activities are something that we in the public sphere are not, in general, well-equipped to discuss. I think that we can see the way Salafi jihadis understand what's going on, but as to Al-Qaeda organizationally, in my view, to the extent they're operating in Tunisia, at least, also in Libya, it's a little bit below the radar. I would say that in Egypt, it's a little bit more explicit, looking at guys like Mohammed al-Zawahiri, Ashush, Marjan Salim, and others. But at any rate, I think that I did a fairly major study that was published late last year looking at Salafi jihadist perceptions of the Arab Spring. And here's how I think that they perceive it. Whether or not the perceptions are accurate could be another topic of discussion. But number one, they perceived the Arab Spring as being very good for them, something that showed the limitations of U.S. power, something that was able to build up their operational capacity, such as major operatives like Marjan Salim, who ended up being released from prison. And the third thing is that in this new environment of openness that exists in both Tunisia and Egypt, that it would create new opportunities to undertake dawah or missionary work for their particularized understanding of Islam. And if, for example, you look at Ansar al-Sharia, Tunisia's ground game, it's a very good ground game. They are able to provide social services. They're very active on social media, which magnifies the perception of them getting out there and providing medicine and providing food and helping communities that are in need. Their social media presence, in fact, makes it look like those things are going on far more than they actually are. They're not actually regularly servicing any given community. They're kind of dispersed throughout the country. But right away, as soon as they go and hand out food somewhere, it's going to be up on Facebook. As a result of their activities and their good ground game, this is a growing movement. It is a movement on the rise. So when Salafi jihadists look at this, I think they see an environment now to undertake dawah in countries like Tunisia and Egypt. There are other countries in which the movement is more actively engaged in violence on the ground. Libya is one. Mali is another. And I have a piece that just came out, published by the International Center for Counterterrorism at The Hague, which looks at this phenomenon and the interplay between lands of dawah and lands of jihad. If you look, for example, at either the Salafis that I mentioned in Egypt or at Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia, these guys have not given up on undertaking violence. AST leaders very explicitly say they have not given up on the idea of jihad, but right now they're not engaged in violence against the state because they want to exploit that and grow their movement. But even while they do that, lands of jihad, places like Libya, where violence is much more acceptable on the part of these groups, can be used to do things like train, something that we know is happening in southern Libya, that can be used to arm the movement. arms have come from Libya through Algeria and into Tunisia. I believe that almost certainly Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is helping to arm Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia for future conflict with the state. So there's an interplay between these two lands, and I think that the way Salafi jihadists look at this, they have a regional strategy, and they believe they're doing a pretty good job of implementing it.
Will, I mean, do you have anything else to add to that?
I do. I think Al-Qaeda, I mean, from early days was chastising the Islamists for being excited about the Arab Spring. And in its propaganda throughout the first year of the Arab Spring, said repeatedly that the West and its local proxies in the Arab world would never allow the Islamists to govern. It's a constant refrain in their propaganda that the Islamists would never be allowed to really govern as they wanted to, either because the West or its local proxies would remove them, or it would so hem them in that these governments wouldn't be able to do anything about it. And I think the coup in Egypt has very much played into that narrative. The problem with the narrative, of course, is that it was primarily targeted towards the Brotherhood, but also included the Salafis who got involved in parliamentary politics. And whereas the Brotherhood has been on the wane, not just in Egypt, but elsewhere in the Arab world, you can see that the Salafis that are engaged in parliamentary politics are a bit more savvy actors, and that they have played the fall of the Brotherhood to their benefit. And I think it's still an open question whether the majority of the Salafi community that's kind of on the fence between of what sort of activism is best for achieving their goals. I think they're still waiting to see how events in Egypt play out.
So then how does sort of Syria, how is that integrated into sort of Al-Qaeda's thinking? I mean, it seems like, I think Thomas Hedgehammer and, or Hedgehammer, not Hedge, and Aaron, they published an article, discussing sort of, Syria being seen as the new civil war or the new, holy crusade. It's civil war being seen as a holy crusade. I mean, where is the war in Syria being integrated into Al-Qaeda's, not only its thinking, but it's sort of its viewpoint, of the Arab Spring?
I think that the most interesting development in terms of Salafi jihadism in Syria is that you have a lot of Salafi militias popping up that are not necessarily ideologically aligned with Al-Qaeda, although they don't mind working operationally with them from time to time. They see themselves as independent. They see themselves as locally focused, so they don't have the global agenda. They're much less critical of the West than Al-Qaeda is. And, of course, we've seen these sorts of groups in the past, and they can change their focus to become more transnational, but they're really in competition for resources with the Al-Qaeda type of groups. And then with Al-Qaeda in Syria, it's a bit of a mess. I mean, they had that huge fallout between the emir of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the emir of the Nusra Front, and they're still feeling the effects of it. I mean, I think they have really been on the wane. I mean, they still have a lot of fighters. They can still do a lot of damage. But in terms of setting the pace for the Salafi groups, I think other groups like Ahrar al-Sham, who have always been quite strong, are really coming to the fore and are becoming the viable alternative, Salafi alternative, to the Al-Qaeda types. And that's why they're soaking up tons of the private money that's pouring in from the Gulf.
I'll add a different angle from the perspective of Al-Qaeda. I think one thing very clearly that Al-Qaeda likes is chaos. And the reason why is very intuitive. This is a group with very utopian goals, goals that almost every analyst would see in the West would see as completely unachievable. And generally, a group with unachievable goals needs something to shake up the system in unimaginable ways in order to bring those goals to fruition. And I think that when you look at it from Al-Qaeda's perspective, Syria is important, but also the ripple effects are very important as well. So to give one example, what happens, there's a large number of Tunisian foreign fighters in Syria, a large number. And Tunisia is not a very big country. You know, it's a country of about 11 million people. So what happens when you have, you know, dozens or hundreds of fighters return from Syria to Tunisia? You know, they might go back to groups like Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia, which is not engaged in warfare against the state, but particularly for guys who've been on the front lines, it might be difficult to incorporate them into a strategy of undertaking dawah. These guys might be very aggressive and might be problematic both for Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia and also for the Tunisian state. This is something that can cause chaos to ripple, and we can see some ripple effects already where refugees have gone. If you're looking at it from Al-Qaeda's strategic perspective, those ripple effects, I think, are extremely important and are something that they will be looking to seize on and exploit.
So, I mean, has Syria, you know, sharpened a sectarian language, or, you know, has that aspect of Al-Qaeda and sort of the Salafi jihadis, you know, their language, that hasn't changed? I mean, because it really seems like, you know, just on a cursory glance, you know, looking at sort of, you know, Aaron's, his database and sort of, you know, other sources, I mean, it really seems like, you know, Syria has introduced or maybe even sharpened that sectarian sort of very much Sunni versus Shiites, you know, very much, you know, the Alawis are, you know, rejectionists, etc. So, I mean, has the conflict in Syria sort of changed that language, you know, sharpened it and made it even, you know, exacerbated it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It sharpened it. I mean, it was on the rise with Iraq in the last decade, and now it has gone into overdrive with Qaradawi coming out with his statement calling for all young men to go fight in Syria against the horrible Alawi state. The fundraising that's being conducted in the Gulf among private citizens, this is the primary talking point, you know, that the Shia are on the rise, that, you know, if we don't stop them there, they're going to be here next. And this is absolutely brought out the worst of the sectarian tensions in the region. And it did not start that way. I mean, this started as a revolt, a peaceful revolt that was quite secular in its language, but sort of the inevitable logic of these things is the more that it grinds on, the more violent that it gets, of course, the more that these fault lines are pushed on by the regime and then by extremist elements in the opposition to the regime, the more people begin to identify with these communities until we get to the past we're in now, where it's being completely defined by even moderates in the region as a Sunni Shia conflict, and we're going to see more of it as it seeps into Lebanon and into Iraq.
I mean, David, do you have a response?
I agree with what he said.
Okay,
that's the best.
How's that for a response?
I agree. So let me. For my last question, you know, I want to ask, you know, has the Arab Spring sort of been detrimental or improved, you know, the position of Islamists? You know, it really seems in the course of our conversation, it's a mixed bag. So, I mean, you know, has the Arab Spring overall improved the position of Islamist, you know, Islamist parties, Salafi jihadis, you know, however you want to tackle this question?
I'll go first. I think it has certainly improved the position of Salafis across the board, whether you're talking about Salafi parliamentarians, the Salafi Hizbah or vigilante groups, or the Salafi jihadis. I think it has been a big win for a variety of reasons. But it helps in all of those cases that they are playing a minority politics. And by playing to a very small base, it gives you a flexibility and a purity, an ideological purity, that is attractive and gives you a cachet that the Brotherhood simply hasn't had, because it has, on the one hand, in trying to come to power, tried to appeal to everybody, and then when coming to power, being unable to deliver on its problems, promises, having the worst of its organizational authoritarian tendencies come out. And I think the big loser has been the Brotherhood, whether they've been Brotherhood in government, or Brotherhood seeking to have a role in a revolution like Syria, where they have effectively marginalized themselves vis-a-vis other militias operating in that conflict.
I agree with Will. I think that it has been good for Salafis across the board. In the case of Salafi jihadists, I think it's been good for them because of the strategic view that I laid out. I think actually it's a pretty good, pretty effective strategic view for the region for these groups so far. In the case of Islamist parliamentarians, as Will, I think, did a very good job outlining, it's been a mixed bag. But overall, I think it's obvious that the Arab uprisings have on net been good for one simple reason, which is that they need, in order to have any chance of being empowered, they needed the old regimes to go away. And so it's difficult to say that the collapse of the old regimes has been bad for them. I think they are better off than they were, 3 years ago.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much, guys, for coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. And, as I said, this is our appetite for destruction.
Thank you.